Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with fascinating medical experts as we discuss a variety of compelling topics. We aim to not only inform you, but to empower you, instilling confidence along your journey toward optimal health. This podcast is brought to you by Brentwood MD. Located just south of Nashville, Tennessee, Brentwood MD provides best-in-class concierge primary care. To learn more about our innovative approach to primary care, visit our website at brentwoodmd.com. On this Spotlight edition of the Future of Medicine podcast, I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Jennifer Kerr, an allergist and immunologist with Heritage Medical Associates in Nashville. Dr. Kerr received her undergraduate degree from Miami University in Ohio. She received a master's in science of neurobiology and physiology from Northwestern University. She received her medical degree from the Medical College of Ohio before completing her medical training in Tennessee. She completed both her residency in pediatrics and her fellowship in allergy and immunology at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Kerr has been practicing since 2009 and specializes in food allergy, asthma, allergic rhinitis, and eczema with Heritage Medical Associates. Join us as we discuss the role of allergy testing, some common food intolerances, and how to approach managing symptoms of environmental allergens. We hope you enjoy this conversation. One of the next questions I had for you is actually shifting gears toward that more anaphylactic type serious.
Yeah.
Let's even just isolate to like a nut allergy.
Sure.
In the school setting, how do you coach parents into how to guide their children and educate their children, but also be sure that there's a safe environment when meals are brought in, snacks are brought in terms of cross-contamination risk and challenges? How do you navigate that with families?
First, I think it's important to just agree that it's tough. It's difficult. It's very difficult to avoid a food allergen strictly, because you can get a 99.999% on this test, but you're going to eat often enough that something's going to happen at some point in time. And so it's hard. I think it's first important just to acknowledge that. And then I think it's also important to acknowledge that kids learn this so well, and they can become such wonderful self-advocates for themselves, that I think it's commonly incredibly surprising to families when they would notice that my four-year-old double checks me when I'm handing them a packet of crackers or cookies and says, "Mom, does that have nuts in it?" And so they're very capable, I would say, first of all. And then I think it's important to also recognize that most children, even with a nut allergy, are not so sensitive that they have to avoid every part per billion that could be there. And so that those sorts of numbers are really important. So when you look at a patient that, let's say, is looking at a label that says may contain trace amounts of a tree nut, that label is very, very unlikely actually to have a tree nut in it. And for the vast majority of patients, even with a nut allergy, they need to look at the part of the label that says if it contains the tree nut.
Okay.
And so the same, because when they've tested the label of a granola bar, for instance, that says it may contain trace amounts, really, it can't be found. And that was done because, as we've seen labels change through the years, there were more and more products that would have on them may contain trace amounts, made in a facility, sat next to a nut last Friday, you know, those kinds of labels that are on there.
Yeah.
And so that tenet also comes into play with, can my child sit at the lunch table next to somebody that might have a nut in their lunch pail? And the reality is that they can, so long as they're old enough to know that they're not going to reach over and eat the food of their neighbor. And because the risk for airborne allergy in that setting is actually exceptionally small. And the vast majority of even nut allergic patients are completely safe in that setting. And that it's actually tremendously important for their anxiety for them to know that they can sit in that seat right next to a food that they're allergic to. And by their choice of just not putting it in their mouth, they're safe. And that reduces quite a lot of anxiety, which really then helps them to become better self-advocates for when they're offered the cookie at the class party, to be able to inquire, is that safe for me? Does that have nuts? Does it have a label on it that we can read? Was it made in somebody's home kitchen? Oh, I need to skip that because we don't know what was in the kitchen, that kind of thing. So I think that when they look at research that would say, does a, you know, a third grader have to sit at a nut-free table? They actually found that there's no difference in accidents at the nut-free table versus a typical table. And so there's really, our National Allergy Society doesn't encourage the isolation that comes with that. They encourage really self-advocacy so that the child can learn what they can and cannot eat.
That's great. Well, reminds me of something I've learned as my kids have grown up, and currently they're, my little girl's 11, my little boy's 9, and I've learned this on the sports field, I've learned it in the classroom, is never underestimate your children. And this is a good example where, you know, they have the ability, even at young ages, to pick up on things and to learn and to be their own advocates and ask the right questions and to do it in a way that minimizes anxiety and makes it a normal conversation, a normal behavior, which obviously, especially at young formative ages, is so impactful when they have a challenge. And how do they overcome that challenge? How do they work around it to keep themselves safe and to minimize that worry? So, thanks for mentioning that.
I guess it would be wise for me to also mention is that we do now have some treatment options for some of the patients with really severe risk food allergies, that there is a medication that we can use now that they doesn't cure food allergy, but it does keep them quite a bit safer from accidental exposures. So we have options now too, which has really been life-changing for some of those patients with really severe food allergy. It's been fantastic.
That's great. Well, let's go back briefly to the gut microbiome. And so you mentioned the fiber, which is amazing. That was not on my radar for being like the first place for us to start that conversation, but it makes so much sense as you say it. What other maybe supplements, nutrition, vitamins, what other things do you find yourself frequently talking about to help balance someone's gut microbiome when they're struggling with either food allergies or intolerances?
That's a great question. To my knowledge, the only supplement that I'm aware of that can help to sort of reduce allergic inflammation in the body is omega fatty acids. That would be the only other supplement that I think there's data to support beyond fiber. Now, when we think about the gut microbiome and diversity, it's interesting to me that other things that can increase the diversity of your gut microbiome are getting a good night's sleep and exercise. So I oftentimes will mention those because they work.
That's great.
More than a supplement.
And this was not a paid advertisement for good, wholesome health foundations. Because I do in my practice, I commonly talk about how just impactful nutrition, fitness, sleep, stress management, relational, spiritual health, my kind of foundations of health, how important they are. And it always is important to realize, that's not only just, you know, good on a bumper sticker, but that is really important to manage certain signs of inflammation, certain symptoms they may have. And it's got evidence behind it.
It has huge amounts of evidence. You know, we're spending all this money looking at all the different details of how does this work in the gut microbiome. And I think that's wonderful and important. Lovely to do all of that work. But it's fascinating that it just comes down to it's what our parents told us. Get a good night's rest. Move. Be kind to yourself. Lower your stress. Those sorts of things.
Do you see anybody come to you taking supplements, vitamins that you feel like may be harmful to them at all? And I say that kind of from the thought of the world we live in with social media and the supplement and vitamin world being so evident throughout. And I say that just as kind of truth. I don't say that with any positive or negative tone. But like you referenced, not a lot of evidence behind certain things, but it's promoted as it could be beneficial. Is there anything you've seen that has been harmful to any of the patients you've worked with?
I can't think of something I've seen anecdotally or personally that I've seen that created significant harm. I can see generally that when you're looking for the solution you know, in this, what is kind of seems like sometimes the fancier snake oil, you know, here we are 100 years later, that we're just missing the boat. And that's the harm, that we aren't focusing on what's important.
Yes.
And that redirection can be, I think, helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, that's really well said. I think how I sometimes verbalize it is kind of keeping first things first.
Yeah.
And keeping kind of the priority list that, you know, don't bring in, you know, remedy number five to try to overcome remedies one through four. Like it, there is a sequential approach to the right behaviors, the right actions, the right treatment. And it's not that number five's wrong. It just needs to be in the right order.
Right.
And not a stretch to overcome maybe the difficulty with adhering to a certain diet or so forth.
Sure. I think the media is really powerful for patients, though. You know, when they look at whatever their favorite form of media is and someone is promoting something, it's hard not to have that fear of missing out, that what if I did that? Yeah. What if that is the right thing for me, when there's not any level of education or evaluation for that patient, or excuse me, for that human promoting whatever it is they're promoting. We don't really know where that's coming from most of the times. Yeah. And so it really creates such work for patients in terms of, okay, well now let me write down this supplement. Let me research that. Let me go down this rabbit hole, which might ultimately be a rabbit hole. And it sort of harkens back to what, you know, if I have an issue with my car, I ask the mechanic. If I have an issue with my body, I ask my favorite physicians.
Yeah.
You know, and then I don't have to carry the stress about 15 things I heard about on some version of media. I just go to the trusted person and ask a question.
Yeah. So true. So pertinent.
Yeah.
Finding the voice you can trust is kind of how I think of it.
And being humble enough to know that I don't have the answer to everything.
Yeah.
Don't need to have the answer to everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no doubt. Well, and as I'd like to transition maybe back with a little bit of truly an ignorant question on my part. I want to transition back to maybe more environmental allergies.
Sure.
But my ignorant question is, do allergy shots or allergy drops have any place in the food allergy spectrum?
Oh, that's a great question. So allergy shots for food allergy, definitely not. The initial studies of those there were profound reactions with those, and those were just stopped completely.
Yeah.
So if someone is proposing an allergy shot for a food allergen, that would make me exceptionally nervous. I mean, there was a fatality in one of the original studies way back when. So that is a no-go.
Gotcha. Allergy. Well, that makes me feel good because I didn't think there was.
Yeah.
But I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
If there wasn't some kind of new evidence or study that like actually you can kind of desensitize someone to a certain food allergy. So
the allergy, you know, sublingual immunotherapy or oral immunotherapy for foods is very real and is a very hot topic that is being looked at. This is only in regard to IgE or anaphylactic risk foods that we do this to. And I think there will be a really great place for using this at some point in time. Although my sense is, and I think even the lead researchers that look at sublingual immunotherapy for foods or oral immunotherapy for foods, is that it's probably not going to be the long-term solution for food allergy. It may be an interlude that we have for now to calm down that level of reactivity for a particular patient because it's the best we have. But there's a fair amount of risk involved in it, and it does require pretty rigorous dosing, pretty routine dosing. And what bothers me with it the most is the limitations that you'll have with it. So when you are doing oral immunotherapy, for instance, there's a limitation in your ability to exercise for a few hours after your dose, and you're supposed to take that dose every day. And so I struggle with that for kids because I don't want them to have to sit still for 2 to 3 hours every day of their life so they don't break.
Yeah.
You know, that's a hard mentality for a child to have. And it's also just difficult to keep, if you can imagine a 7-year-old boy, for instance, being told to sit still every day for 2 hours so they didn't react to the microdose of the peanut that they ate.
Yeah.
That's hard.
It is.
That's hard. And maybe not the best decision for that 7-year-old boy, for instance, if he wants to play on the baseball team and he's got to go to school, and there's just no time in the day for that actually then. So that's where, when you look at some of the barriers, there's looking at different adjustments and dose and how we might be able to make that happen using the sublingual immunotherapy, keeping it lower dose and not creating as much risk. So it can be, it's all about individualizing the therapy to the patient and what their needs are.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
How about for other allergies, environmental allergies? What's the role of the immunotherapies with either allergy shots or oral drops?
Yeah.
Tell me kind of what, when I should be thinking about those.
So in any patient that has environmental allergies that are impacting their airway, so creating asthma, not just on maybe a one-time basis, but with any level of regularity, that would be a time to see an allergist, understand what those allergens are, and is an indication to consider allergy injections. So when you look at asthma guidelines, if you have allergic asthma, a course of allergy injections or allergy shots is indicated. There's also patients that have impact from their sleep. So if allergies are impacting their sleep and creating sleep disordered breathing, or if they have sleep apnea, that's also another reason to think about that next level of care of considering allergy shots rather than just medications. A patient with snoring tendencies or sleep apnea could be a candidate for allergy drops. I don't utilize allergy drops in my practice because they tend to be less effective than the allergy shots. And so maybe that's a part of my personality, but if we're going to go for this process, we're going to go for the one that's going to be the most effective.
Yeah.
And the, however, the shots are more inconvenient to patients. But I think if you have any level of inflammation infecting your airway, I'd rather go for the most effective way, I think truly is my thought. Now, allergy drops, if you have asthma, are contraindicated just because it's of the level of airway inflammation that is there. Yeah.
Gotcha.
But allergy shots are a highly effective treatment. You know, vast majority of patients respond positively and have significantly less inflammation in their airway, and can their asthma symptoms go pretty significantly down and are able to use significantly less medications and feel better and all of those positive type things. Yeah. Allergy injections also can help the immune system to fight viral infections better because they get rid of the allergic inflammation that's sort of getting in the way of that. So there's really a lot of positive that can come from them. The downside being the cost and the amount of time involved. So typically for seasonal hay fever, for instance, we may just recommend an antihistamine or a nasal steroid spray if you're going to use that once or twice a year for a month, not the course of allergy injections. But for other influences of those environmental allergens, when it gets to the point of asthma or sleep troubles, then definitely it can be indicated.
Thank you for saying that. That's so once again, to help, you know, to repeat, but hopefully be clear, you're really thinking about it with the airway involvement. Not so much just the classic symptoms of itchy, watery eyes, postnasal drip, irritating cough.
Now, they can be super helpful for all of that. Yeah. And it is definitely an indication if quality of life is impacted. You know, we meet several patients who are like, I just can't sit at my child's ball game.
Yeah.
It's just so uncomfortable. Yeah. And you'll meet as children sometimes that their symptoms are so heavy during those seasons that they're not able to enjoy outside time. And in children, it's actually interesting if they have really strong amount of environmental allergies, let's say as an elementary school student, that if you did a course of allergy shots, you can actually prevent the development of asthma. So there's definitely a role for your typical severe hay fever. I usually leave that to the patients to let me know.
Yeah.
Is that to this point yet?
Gotcha.
Can we use medicines for
Well, that's a great frame of reference to be in. And as you say that, I think of the alternative kind of management philosophy of just managing the symptoms as opposed to really in a way, I don't know if you'd use this term, but more of a curative type approach.
Yeah, it's an immune modulatory treatment.
Yeah, so kind of the management versus cure of sorts. But so let's talk about management of kind of those classic, maybe more hay fever, environmental allergy symptoms. And I've always kind of said it tongue in cheek a bit to patients that, you know, if you go to any pharmacy, there's two whole aisles of options. And if just one thing worked, you wouldn't have a thousand options. True. And so how do we help our patients navigate what to reach for when amid all the options of pills and sprays and drops everywhere? So
it's a great question. Much of basic environmental allergy medication management is available over the counter now because you can get your antihistamines over the counter. So that would be your Zyrtec and Zizol and Allegra and Claritin. Those would be your newer generation antihistamines. So they're not as sedating as, say, Benadryl, which used to be the main antihistamine that we had before those medications. Those medicines are going to be great for itching and dripping, sneezing. Then you also have your nasal steroid spray. So you're going to have that your Flonase, Nasonex, and Rhinocort, and Nasacort. And those are going to be applied in the nose, and they're going to reduce inflammation in the back part of the nose and into the sinus. And so you're going to have a reduction in congestion. It's also going to help to reduce sneezing and itching and dripping as well. Yeah. And then you'll have antihistamine nasal sprays now, which are going to be basically like putting one of the antihistamines such as Zyrtec directly in the nose. And these would be Pattenase and Azelastine and Astepro. Mm-hmm. And that those will help quite a bit with drainage and also some with congestion.
Yeah.
One of the pills left that's not over the counter is Singulair, which is a prescription that can help quite a bit with congestion and also asthma.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so for patients, I think it depends on their symptoms, you know, and then they all respond differently. So that's why you'll see that when it comes to the antihistamines in particular, some patients will say, oh, I do so much better if I take Allegra versus if I take Zyrtec, and, or they'll say, oh, Zizol makes me tired, so I take Allegra. And so really I would personalize that to whatever the patient feels best with.
Yeah, I definitely see that. And it's always a challenge to navigate patients in, you know, how to balance their routine of therapy where they feel like they've been on maybe Zyrtec long enough. They don't feel like it's working.
Yeah.
And then I don't have necessarily the confidence to be like, oh, just use Claritin, you know, because it is so similar, but people do respond differently. And so, getting a small pack of Claritin, would you take that kind of same 2-week approach like we did with some of the, you know, discussion about the elimination diet? Like, hey, try Claritin for 2 weeks. And if you feel like it's better, maybe stick with that for a while.
I think it's reasonable that I also think that I'd give it maybe 2 days because you're going to know pretty quickly if that antihistamine is making a difference for you. When it comes to the antihistamines, then I would give it actually pretty quick if this is going to be helpful or not. But that's going to be pretty clear. And I do hear that a lot that, oh, if I switch my antihistamine to this one, I felt better. And then I switched it back. To my knowledge, there's no evidence to show that we actually develop a tolerance to antihistamines in that way. But if it helps, I'm all for it. It's a really benign change and
Any role for oral antihistamines and nasal antihistamines, or do they overlap?
That's a great question. Some allergists would say it doesn't make any sense to take them both together because they're both antihistamines. So if we can double our Zyrtec safely, then just double your Zyrtec rather than adding another spray. Mm-hmm. I would say that I can see validity in that argument, but I also can say that I have a lot of patients that really feel the nasal antihistamines make a big difference. And if you use the nasal antihistamines in combination with a nasal steroid spray, that can be a really lovely combination to calm down the drip and the congestion and sneezing and all of the above.
Great. Well, thanks for going through those.
Yeah.
Any natural remedies that you recommend? You know, people always often talk about like local honey and various things. Are there any natural remedies that you feel like maybe have some evidence behind them?
There was initially a bit of excitement about honey in terms of if it could actually be a natural remedy, but it wasn't confirmed.
Didn't pan out.
Yeah. It's incredibly safe food to eat, and there could be, and still, I still say there could be some theoretical properties in honey that could be helpful. And if you're that one that it helps, great. There's no harm in coming from it.
Great. Well, we'll pivot a little bit and kind of our last topic, one I know you're really passionate about, is asthma.
Yeah.
And so we've touched on it a little bit with kind of the airway involvement of maybe upper respiratory allergies, but I'd love to talk just a little bit about all the options of asthma treatment, and I'd love for you to kind of walk me through how to select the best respiratory treatment for a patient from kind of maybe the intermittent, or even actually we could even start with maybe some exercised isolated asthma, and then kind of through the spectrum of severity of cases.
Sure. So asthma is something that we can do so much more for anymore. I mean, really is, it's a condition that there's a lot of options. I think that the first step is to recognize that asthma is simply a pattern of coughing and wheezing, which is a really general term. And there's been a big movement in our field to phenotype or categorize what kind of asthma you have so we can better understand what's driving that pattern of coughing or wheezing.
Yeah.
So first, understanding what drives it can be very helpful, and then understanding how often it happens. So if you have asthma that's triggered from exercise or cold air, or only exercise in the cold air, or really just something that's intermittent in general, not happening all the time, but very just occasionally, then there's some great inhalers we can use.
Yeah.
That we can have you use 20 minutes before exercise, or we can keep around in case you get that bad virus that's going to trigger some asthmatic reactivity in you. Something that just is very intermittent, we would typically treat with just some inhalers, and actually potentially never even a visit with me.
Yeah.
If we get into the more persistent levels of asthma, where you have a more persistent issue with cough or wheezing or trouble breathing, then we really do, in my opinion, need to look at, well, what's driving it, and then go after that. You know, there's allergy is obviously one of the most common causes of that, whether that's indoor allergens or outdoor allergens. The outdoor seems to be rather obvious. Those are patients that can't walk outside in April without wheezing.
Yeah.
And the indoor can be a little bit quieter, because that just can be, if you have, let's say, a dust mite allergy, you might just be twitchy pretty often when it comes to trigger for cough or wheezing. And you may not realize that it is the dust mites that are there. And that's where the testing can be useful in helping us identify what those triggers are. You can also have variants of asthma that are secondary to acid reflux, or you can have some that are secondary to nasal polyps or aspirin sensitivity. So really pinning down what other driving factors are there can be really helpful at us thinking about things. And that helps us choose our treatments.
Yeah.
So our treatments can elevate to stronger inhalers. We can look at lab work to help define different biologics. There's several biologics for asthma now, so that we have medicines that can target certain parts of the immune system to calm down inflammation in strategic ways and to help you breathe a lot better. And then, of course, as we mentioned earlier, even a course of allergy injections. I typically would put a course of allergy injections ahead of biologics, because you've got, if you have allergic asthma, you have a much greater potential of really modifying that immune system and that airway over time. And you're using a treatment methodology that's been around 100 years, rather than having a patient sort of chronically need to be on medication like a biologic.
Yeah. That's great. Well, Dr. Carr, thank you so much for joining me on this episode. And for our listeners, we'll be sure to put it on our website, but they can get in touch with you if they need your services at Heritage Medical Associates, and the website and your office either in downtown Nashville or in the Cool Springs, Franklin area. And so you've been so helpful to many, many of my patients. And I thank you for that. And I know this conversation will be valuable to many more. So
absolutely.
Thanks for
Happy
your time.
Yes.
Thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional resources at BrentwoodMD.com. Be sure to check out all of our other content that we've created by searching BrentwoodMD on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. If our content has provided you with value, it would mean the world to us if you subscribed to the show and left a review. This helps us ensure that more people, just like you, can find our content so that they can begin optimizing their health. To learn more about our concierge services that we provide to our members, visit BrentwoodMD.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professional.